Well, this was quite an effort and a huge book and packed with all sorts of facts and information. I had no idea. All of the personnel, you didn't leave anybody out of that period now, did you?
Oh, I very carefully selected the best ones, the most exciting people of that era. Not just Lincoln, but the best woman spy, Rose Greenough, who more than Mata Hari had an effect on a war. She was the southern spy in the northern capital, and she provided the information that helped the Confederate forces win at the Bull Run. And then there's John Breckinridge, a man in the middle. He was the youngest vice president we ever had, who a Kentuckian, who was caught. He was in the Senate, and he did not want to go to war. He didn't think that was a civil war was really necessary. And he wanted to work out a peace between the North and South. And he was caught in the middle. And today we would think a man like that was doing the right thing for the country, trying to avert 600,000 casualties. But he was pretty much derided in the North and not too well received in the South. And ultimately was driven South and became a Confederate general. That's the sort of people and the sort of stories that you can use to help tell the message that I wanted to get across.
Well, let's talk about the genesis of Freedom. This is Freedom, of course, is not your first book, but it's your first novel, isn't it?
No, I did a novel about 10 years ago called Full Disclosure, about a president who had gone blind and they try to push him out onto the basis of the 25th Amendment. So I had some experience writing a novel, but this one, I was scratching my head trying to figure out how to get across the idea of liberty, personal liberty, versus national security. It's the big struggle of our time. I was in the Nixon White House. I was a speechwriter. And I remember how raped I felt when it turned out that I was wiretapped without my knowledge. And I said to myself, how can that be?
Well, that was in the interest of national security.
That's the way it was explained to me by Al Haig at the time. That got me thinking, how much personal liberty do individuals have to give up to provide for the national security? Assuming the country wants to maintain freedom, there has to be a balance struck between not leaking anything or not saying anything disloyal versus being a free individual. And it's never an easy thing to hit, never an easy balance to strike. And as I began to look at it, it seemed to me that the Lincoln administration was the perfect example of where that that balance was most in contest. And that's when I started writing this novel.
But you must have also had some sort of fascination or obsession with Lincoln himself.
Yes, I've been hooked on him since I was a kid. But most people, and I was one of them, thought of Lincoln as the Lincoln myth, the man sitting there in the chair looking benign in the Lincoln Memorial. The Carl Sandburg Lincoln, that's the one we're brought up on. Kindly, humorous, suffering, and above all, presidential. Well, that's not the real man. The real man is a lot more interesting. And when you drop the scales of reverence from your eyes and look at Lincoln as a president and not as a successor to Moses and Jesus, he's not a spiritual figure. He's a quite secular man in our lives, in the lives of our politics.
Well, how did we develop this myth about Lincoln?
Well, one thing was he was martyred. Now, martyr is a religious term.
So was Garfield.
Yeah, but he wasn't martyred during a civil war, or just after a civil war. That was the culmination, really, of a...
What about McKinley, the Spanish-American War? He was martyred.
The national bloodletting of the Civil War created the martyr. The reason that Garfield, who also is a character in my book as a major in the Army, and McKinley and and Kennedy were not considered martyrs. They were considered assassinated presidents because they did not come out of a national experience that was so rending as the Civil War. So here you had Lincoln, who was sealed in our national consciousness as the martyr, the one who gave up his life that the Union might live. And his myth was helped along by his secretaries, Nicolay and Hay, who made everybody who opposed him look like a villain, including people in the North who opposed him for perfectly noble reasons. And this was sold to us over the years, besides which people need a myth, a people like an epic hero. So I think when Professor Randall in the 30s and 40s began his revisionism, it was accepted by historians but never bought by the people. And so I bought it, and I'm a political pundit. I make my living looking at presidents with jaundiced eyes. I'm sitting here looking at you with jaundiced eyes as we speak. That's the way my eyes are. And I
have a little bloodshot.
Well, that's the same kind of thing. And so in looking at Lincoln, I see a sometimes devious, quite political, sometimes quite cruel when it comes to accepting casualties and seeking a general who will grind down the other side. And tortured and melancholy to the point of depression occasionally. But above all, a man with a central idea, a purpose, a purposefulness that no other president, with the possible exception of Washington, had. And that's what makes him probably our greatest president, that he knew what he was president for.
Well, one thing, certainly as you began to do your research for freedom, you had plenty to draw on, didn't you?
It's as if there were a tape recorder going on in that White House. If there had been wires, there would have been wiretapping. Everybody kept diaries. Everybody wrote letters to everybody else. There was no telephone. The great advantage to history, there was no telephone in that administration because telephone conversations get lost. The Library of Congress is great on it. The New York Public Library is pretty good, too.
Where did you do the bulk of your research?
Well, as I was traveling around the country for the New York Times doing my job, I would stop in to local antiquarian bookstores and pick up books on the Civil War. And in every city, there's a couple of good old bookstores. And I got to know them and built up a library of the Civil War. And then on specific technical things, there was this Library of Congress, which is helpful to anybody who wants to be a scholar.
You built up your own archive.
Yeah, but here's an example. There was a meeting that I was particularly interested in, the most important cabinet meeting in American history, July 22nd, 1862, when Lincoln called his cabinet together and said, I've decided to emancipate the slaves. Now, most accounts of that meeting don't paint it as a particularly dramatic session. I mean, Lincoln said he's going to do it, and some people suggested waiting until perhaps there was a victory so it wouldn't seem like a desperation move, and so he postponed it. I'd wondered about that. I've been in cabinet meetings. I used to sit against the wall in the Nixon cabinet and listen to them. And I know that there are big passions sometimes that underlie these meetings. And in that meeting, according to the diaries of a couple of the men present, Montgomery Blair of Blair House, the postmaster general, a powerful family, he was the politician in the Lincoln's cabinet, he said, according to these diaries, that he would submit a memo to the president objecting to the idea of emancipation. And the memo never appeared. I mean, nobody ever saw it. And that struck me as curious for two reasons. One, Blair was a anti-slavery man. He argued the case as a volunteer lawyer for Dred Scott, the runaway slave. He was also a cabinet member who was responsible. And when you stand up in a cabinet meeting and say, Mr. President, I'll give you a memo on this, you better give him the memo. I mean, otherwise you look like a jerk. So I asked the Library of Congress, where's that memo? They said they didn't have it. A couple of years later, I get a call. You the guy that was looking for that Montgomery Blair memo? Yeah. Well, we found it. It was misfiled for a century or so under the Chase papers. And so I had a chance to read it. And there was his rationale, which was fascinating, about what went on in that meeting. Essentially, he said, look, you can't free the slaves, because if you do, there'll be a backlash in the North of whites worried about blacks coming north and taking their jobs. In the 1862 elections in a couple of months, we'll lose to the Democrats. The Democrats will settle the war with the South. The South will secede, and you will not have stopped slavery. You can't do it this way. Now, that's a perfectly legitimate attitude to take for somebody who is anti-slavery, saying, don't emancipate the slaves this way. And can you imagine then what went on in that meeting? The self-examination and the weighing of politics. Well, I was able then to spread it all out on the table and redo that meeting as a dramatic scene. And I tell you, it just came alive.
And in a way, you've been able to amplify what the historians have told us. You found information that just wasn't there.
Well, I like historians. I've relied heavily on historians. A lot of them disagree. And few of them, in fact, none of them who's a good historian, will get inside the head of a character and say, this is what he was really thinking. I mean, historians have a certain discipline, saying, I'll only go as far as the facts let me go. Well, a novelist can go a little further and take the facts up to the crucial moment and then say, this is why he did what he did. And take the reader along, and you can see the motives of the men as they clash.
Well, I want to ask you a little more about that in a second, but just to go back so we're a little more coherent in how this book was organized and planned. You had done all of this research. You checked out certain facts at the Library of Congress. You collected a lot of books on your own. So you had all of this material. How then did you plan to organize it? How did that come about? So that you could make so that you could actually structure the book.
Well, I mislead people in the on the cover. The subtitle is a novel of Abraham Lincoln and the Civil War. Of is the misleading word. People assume that means about. It's not a novel about the Civil War or about Abraham Lincoln. It's a novel about a theme. And the theme is this balance between individual liberty and national security. How much freedom do each of us have to give up in order to maintain freedom as a nation? So that was my theme. And I looked for the beginning and the end of the clash of civil liberty versus national security in the Lincoln administration. And it pretty much presented itself. The beginning, when he suspended habeas corpus, when he, in other words, said martial law exists and the courts come second, and he was clashing with the Chief Justice, who said you can't do that. And the culmination in the irony of the Emancipation Proclamation. So that was my time frame. And then I concentrated on the half dozen people who brought it about. And that was my structure.
Well, did you draw yourself a chart indicating where you wanted to go from one chapter to another, from one event to another?
Oh, sure. I had charts.
How did you do this?
And I had outlines, and I had the things I hung up on my wall. After I wrote the book from beginning to end, I realized how I wanted to end it. And then that was 3 or 4 years into the project. And I had a good editor at Doubleday who said, hey, it's a good political tract, but it's not a story. And you don't do enough with your characters. And there are certain characters that just sort of drop out halfway and others that get introduced too late. And you got to remember, you're writing a novel. And at that point, I had my message more clearly in my mind. So I went back from the beginning. And with the aid of writing on a word processor, which was different from writing on a typewriter, made editing a lot easier, I rewrote the whole thing. So it took 8 or 9 years, but I wasn't in a rush. And it's long, but a reader doesn't have to be in a rush. And then I got... what took me so long, really, was to do the afterbook or the underbook at the back. What bugged me, and perhaps bugs most readers of historical fiction, is you never know where the facts end and the imagination of the novelist begins. And I worry about that. I mean, is this true, what I'm reading? And so what I've done for the buff, for the Civil War buff, and there are lots of them, in the back of the book, chapter by chapter, I say, look, this is fact, this is fiction. And of the facts, here's where this historian says it went this way, and here's where I think it went that way. And I can be a pundit, I can be a columnist in the back of the book, commenting on the action of the book as it goes. You don't have to read the underbook. If you want to read it as a novel, great, you read it as a novel. But for those who are curious about the way it really was, and did this woman love this guy, it's all in the back.
Well, the book is so long, this looks as though this might have been a full-time project, but you have a regular full-time job. I mean, you turn out a column 3 times a week.
The secret is I don't play golf and I don't play tennis.
Probably don't drink very much either.
And when you add those three things together, and my kids are grown up and they've moved out, and so and when, and a lot of coffee break time can go into this too. So when you add up your hours, your leisure hours, and weekends, you can work on a book if you're not eager to get it out in a year.
Of course, you work out of your home.
Yes,
so
I
you
do my
column out of your home.
No, I do my column out of the New York Times office in Washington.
You actually go to the office to do it?
You bet.
And, well, Baker, Russell Baker was telling me he sends his in through his modem.
Right. But Russ has the anguish and advantage of writing a humor column. And I have the excitement of writing a column on the news.
Oh, you like to go to the wires and read the papers?
Yeah, and talk to the reporters who really know what's going on in the bureau. And it's good to get up and get out of the house in the morning, too, and go somewhere. When you're writing a historical novel, you have to project yourself back a century or so. I had a trick in doing that. When I had a day to write my novel, I would not read that morning's New York Times that was delivered to the door. But instead, I would I had a bound copy of all the New York Times's for the years 1861 and 1862. And if I was writing about July 22nd, I would turn to July 22nd and read the paper that day with the ads and everything. And that would help slip me back in time.
You also have something rather unusual for a novel. You have pictures.
You
don't see that
too
often.
That's because I'm terrible at writing descriptions of people. And I figured since everybody in my novel is a real person, instead of my describing them, show their picture. And some of the pictures were difficult to find. Anna Ella Carroll, who was an important character, she was a pamphleteer who was also a military strategist who never got any credit for her great military strategy contribution to the Union side. Because who thought that a woman and a civilian could think up these great strategic things in the West? There were no known photograph of her. I was able to find an engraving taken from a Matthew Brady photograph. So you can see what she actually looked like.
What was the reaction of the editors at Doubleday when they began to see how long this book was shaping up to be?
They were very good about it. They said, look, this is how thick a book can be and be bound, 2 1/4 inches. And if you want to go with the manuscript you brought in, which was about 675,000 words, but some of the words I used twice, you will then have to go with a very tiny type and rather thin pages that won't take photographs well. But we'll print it, they said, if you do that. Well, I thought about it, and I went through, and I cut about 10% out. I mean, the whole Trent affair, out the window. If anybody wants 25,000 words on the Trent affair, I've got them. But I cut the book to about 600,000 words. and so that the type size is readable, and the page quality is good for photographs. And curiously enough, as every writer knows, that last squeeze is good for the book. It's good for the tautness of the book.
Well, it looks like a better book than Doubleday usually turns out.
That was the old Doubleday you're thinking of. This is the new Doubleday. They've just been bought by a big international company. They put in a new president, Nancy Evans, and there's a whole new attitude of Doubleday, and it's great to see.
Well, this is a nice-looking book, because most of the old Doubleday books I've seen are they fall apart in 2 minutes.
Those days are gone forever.
Yeah, and this is an all cloth binding.
Mm-hmm. Good end papers too, you know.
Yeah, and so it's a good quality book. Doubleday is glad to see Doubleday is doing that, because they've had good authors that they've given shoddy looking books to, so they didn't do that with Freedom. But you could have done something like two volumes, but that would make it look like a history book, wouldn't it?
Right, and I'm not writing a history. I'm writing a novel about a mighty theme. And it belongs in one book.
Well, a year or two from now, when the paperback version comes out, are they going to have problems putting that together because of the size?
No, 1,000-page books appear in paperback. I mean, you can buy Les Miserables in paperback, or Jim Mitch and His Texas, or Ladies of the Club, or Jim Clavell's Whirlwind was 1,000 pages. There seems to be a willingness on the book-buying public on the part of the book-buying public, to buy books that are offer a whole week's reading experience, or 30 hours of reading. And I think it's a good idea. If you're willing to get into a world, why do you have to zip through a book in an evening? Make a commitment and get to know the characters and live the experience.
Isn't it interesting that while you did all of this research, and for Freedom, and you acquired a lot of text history books as you went around the country, most people, I think, now I could be wrong, but maybe you can amplify this, I have a feeling that most readers don't turn to the history books to find out about history. They turn to books like yours. They turn to novels, because I think it illuminates history in a very readable, direct way that people like a movie.
Well, in reviewing my book, I know that C. Van Woodward and others get into the whole idea of historical fiction. And historians grimly make the point that you made, saying that most people don't get their history from us. They get it from Tolstoy and War and Peace, on Napoleon, or from Margaret Mitchell and Gone with the Wind on the Civil War. And they wish that the novelists would get a little bit more historical. Well, okay, I got more historical here, but I tried to remember that people are interested in people, and people, historical characters, create the conflicts that illuminate the great messages.
You have a reputation of being kind of a modern-day Mencken, not because of your political attitudes necessarily, but because of your interest in words and language. You must have applied this interest to Freedom, because people talked in a certain way in the 19th century that they don't talk now. So how did you reconcile this problem?
I noticed in the course of our talk, you have not made a single egregious grammatical error, and I'd just like to salute you for that. Yes, you watch out for anachronisms particularly. I referred to a memorial that was written by Montgomery Blair, and not a memorandum, because a century ago, those memos were called memorials. And so I had to be careful, even though most people would look at it and say, he means memorandum, doesn't he? Not memorial. Memorial is the thing that Lincoln sits in on in Washington. So you say to yourself, okay, they're not going to quite get that, but that's the way they spoke back then. So I had to watch that. I'm sure I've made some mistakes there. There must be some anachronisms I've got in there, and I'm certain that the readers and historians will point them out. But yes, I adopted speech patterns that were used at the time. They sound a little talky compared to the kind of mumbling, and I mean kind of dialogue we are so accustomed to now.
Well, you finished Freedom. It's written, it's in manuscript form, it's in the hands of the publisher. However, you probably had some gnawing doubts that maybe there were some historical inaccuracies. Now, how did you make sure that there weren't any?
Interesting how doubts usually gnaw, right? And there they are, sitting there, chewing away on those bones. I'm sorry, what was your question again?
I shouldn't have used gnawing doubts. That is a cliche anyway. But anyway, you did want to check the historical accuracy of Freedom, probably from other sources.
Yes, I went to Gabor Borut, who was a professor of history at Gettysburg College. And I said to him, look, will you vet the book? Will you go through it? And when you see obvious errors, flag them. And when you disagree with my judgments, put a check mark there, too. So he caught God knows how many errors of battles that were fought on a wrong day or people who had died before they said something. And mostly errors that I picked up from fine books of history, including Sandburg. But so I made as many fixes as I could. A few errors that I did not run past him slipped through. I refer to Libby Prison as if it were a northern prison. But when it came to the judgments, when I said this is why I think Lincoln did this, and he challenged me on the judgment, I would then think to myself, well, okay, that's what he thinks, and this is what I think. And I would then go with my own judgment.
Yeah, and you don't have to justify it.
Anyway. Oh, sure I do.
No,
I justify it in the back.
The novelist does not have to justify anything.
No, I disagree. I went in the back of the book and I justified it. And I said, look, most historians think this. I'm taking the opposite point of view. I'm saying I think when Lincoln said that he wanted to colonize the slaves, in other words, send them back to Africa or down to Panama, that he was kidding himself or he was deliberately conning the people. To all the people who are worried in the North about suddenly if there was freedom for the slaves, they would be competing with them for jobs. And they would drive down the white labor. So he had to assuage their worry. And the way he did it was by fooling them, by saying, don't worry, they're not going to come North. We're all going to ship them out somewhere to some congenial clime. Now, I think that was a case of Lincoln half fooling himself, saying maybe the problem will go away, or deliberately deceiving northern public opinion. Now, not everybody agrees with me on that. Historians generally act a little gingerly about that and say, well, he didn't really mean that, and don't confront what was obvious to me as a political pundit, a deliberate deception. Now, I justify what I think in the back of the book. And if you don't agree, I'll give you places to go to read the other side of that issue.
Well, slavery was certainly a disgraceful episode in the history of our country. And the Civil War was a terrible, wrenching moment in our history. And Freedom does a lot to illuminate the agony of that period. A lot of interest in this book. And I think it's a remarkable achievement and a real work of effort, and I'm delighted that you had the time. I know you've done a lot of promotion on the book, but I'm glad you were able to slip me in order to illuminate how this book came about. I want to thank you very much for coming in and talking to me.
Thank you.